Premier Christian Newscast. In the late Victorian era, at the height of the Industrial Revolution, a number of churches in working-class English towns decided the best way to keep local men out of the pubs and out of trouble was to start football clubs for them to play in instead. Fast forward a century and a half, and many of those very same clubs are now multi-billion pound international entertainment businesses starring at the top of the Premier League. And yeah, despite all that change, the links between football and the church persist. Late last year, the Football Association itself even held a big event at Wembley Stadium to celebrate Christians in the football world and to explore the interplay between the beautiful game and Christianity. You're listening to the Premier Christian Newscast. I'm Tim Wyatt. As an obsessive football fan myself, come on you Gunners, I was fascinated and intrigued by finding out how churches have been historically, and still are today, deeply engaged in our national pastime. So, in an admittedly slightly self-indulgent move, I've brought together Michael Wakelin, a former BBC religion producer and devoted Norwich City fan who pulled the FA event together, with Graham Daniels, a former professional player, manager and now director at Cambridge United and the head of Christians in Sport. Our conversation on all things faith and football ranged from muscular Christianity to faith literacy to evangelism inside the dressing room. I hope you enjoy. Well, thank you, Graham and Michael, for joining us on the show. Could I start by asking you each to kind of briefly introduce yourselves and your connection with the world of football? Michael, why don't you go first?
Well, I have a very long connection with the world of football through supporting Norwich City since I was a little boy. I really am a lifelong canary. And I used to go to matches on my own from the age of about 12, I remember. I don't know why my parents left me, because going to football matches, because I'm very old, going to football matches back then was actually quite a dangerous activity. And I remember being quite frightened by some of the teams like Leeds when they came to Carrow Road. It was very scary. But my career has taken me into broadcasting and interfaith understanding. I was at the BBC for many years. I ended up as head of religious broadcasting. But I didn't really know anything about religion and broadcasting until I left, actually. Then I became quite an expert on interfaith activity and particularly understanding that the joys and the pressures of faithful Britain, as it were. I went freelance in 2010. I run the Religion Media Centre, which is going great guns at the moment. It's got a fabulous new grant, and we're helping journalists cover religion. I also deal with big organisations, helping them to accommodate religion in the workplace. Don't know how much you want. I'm also executive producer of Pause for Thought. But I love football. I've infected my sons with the Norwich City disease, and even though we live near Manchester. And we go to games a lot. We're going to watch Norwich v Stoke on Saturday, so I'm very excited about that.
Brilliant. And Graham, who are you?
I played football as a boy for Cardiff City and then moved to Cambridge United, and I've managed non-league teams really right through into my 40s, sort of Conference North or South, as people would know them in football. And then probably for the last 12 years, I've been a director of Cambridge United in League One. So that's the football side of it. I couldn't be a football fan when I was a boy because I grew up in Llanelli in South Wales. Yeah. Football was barred. It was rugby or bust in Wales in the 70s. So no access to football there. And I suppose the combination of Michael, I've been privileged to overlap with Michael a couple of times in life. I think partly because I've always had an academic interest in sport and faith. I became a Christian in my early 20s, or came to a personal faith in my 20s. I guess I spent 40 years working out from inside football how that relationship of a belief in God and a faith in Christ, in my case, works, the tacit feel of it in everyday life in football. And a bit like Michael, just to close my introduction, I feel too, the longer I've gone, the better understanding I'm beginning to get of how the whole thing hangs together. So I hope I live a bit longer because there's plenty to think about, really.
Brilliant. Well, I'm really pleased to have you guys both on the show to hear some of your thoughts on this. I should declare an interest as a passionate, lifelong Arsenal fan. This is mixing of work and pleasure at the moment. But football and Christianity go back quite a long way, don't they? Because I understand actually quite a lot of the clubs we're familiar with today, a lot of the Football League, Premier League clubs, had actually were started by churches or by Christians. Could you share any stories that you're aware of, or how does that connection, how does that begin in, I guess, the kind of Victorian era?
Well, I think Graham will know much more about this, so I'll let him talk in a moment. But I found all this out when Songs of Praise, of which I was series producer, we decided to do a football programme from Old Trafford. And we thought if we filled a quarter of the ground, we would have done a good job. And that would have been about 10,000 people. We actually ended up with a waiting list of 10,000 people for the whole stadium. It was really exciting. But I did a lot of research then as I was researching the programme and into the origins of football clubs. And yeah, most of them, it seems to me, are based roughly around churches and boys' clubs at churches to stop boys from getting into trouble. They played football. And certainly ones like Aston Villa, Graham will confirm, but Everton, Manchester City was an Anglican boys' club. And also I discovered more recently that the same is true in Germany. And a lot of the clubs in Germany were based on churches as well. So, yeah, Graham will correct me, but that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely true. And I think one of the unchanging things in that 100 years is the vision of Christians inside their own culture. In the 19th century, obviously, it was significant industrialization of society. So in those big cities where they're increasing factory work, it was the churches who were saying, well, look, if people are getting half a day off, we're much better off helping them, helping the working men, particularly, as well as young people. But the working men, we're much better off helping them to have fun that doesn't involve spending your money down the boozer, really. That's what it amounted to, because it was community without alcohol. But the churches saw the social need, as in many ways in our own era, churches have tried to identify areas where Christians can make a difference to the world, make the world a better place. So, yeah, huge. And perhaps the one thing to add from a time Michael and I, just before Christmas, were at Wembley with the Football Association, we uncovered that Lord Kinnaird, who was president of the FA for years and years and years in the 19th century, I was responsible for the building of Wembley Stadium. He was a very, very keen Christian with Cambridge University, played in 9 FA Cup finals, won 5 or 6, a ridiculous number. But Lord Kinnaird was a very keen Christian man who saw the importance, not just at local level, but at national FA level, of football to make a difference to our country. And he died in 1924, 100 years before our gathering together with the Football Association at Wembley at Christmas time. So yeah, very, very long and respectable relationship between the church and football.
And I want to come back to that Wembley event in a bit late, in a minute, but just, you know, was this kind of growing out of what's often called a kind of muscular Christianity that was quite popular at that point, this idea that, you know, Christians needed to be vigorous and it's about building character. So it wasn't just about, you know, keeping boys off the street, but it was also about instilling Christian virtues through the power of sport.
Yeah, the muscular Christianity moniker, it really is a public school thing, as opposed not necessarily simultaneous with the development of sport amongst churches in industrialized areas, but muscular Christianity itself comes out of rugby school and Thomas Arnold, the head teacher there, Tom Brown's school days, where the Christian faith in public schools was about morality, ethics, country, other people. And so that's what underpins muscular Christianity. And of course, therefore, it's the great, the Cambridge Seven, for example, were great embodiments of muscular Christianity, where these fantastic athletes at Cambridge in the 19th century famously go off to China as missionaries, but they're the best sports people at Cambridge in the late 19th century. So it's an embodiment of a vision of Christianity that is strong and robust and purpose-driven and motivated for good. You could almost say it's the flip side of the church developments of the 19th century, because so many of the clergy who are responsible for working class football engagement were people who'd been educated at Cambridge and Oxford, who were the muscular Christians. So a Fulham Football Club, off the top of my head, Fulham Football Club, now in the Premier League, started because muscular Christians who'd been at Cambridge with the Cambridge Seven didn't want to go abroad, but wanted to make a difference in Britain. And that was behind Fulham Football Club. So pretty exciting, two sides of the coin with the posh people and the working classes all amalgamating around football, just like Arsenal.
A truly class-spanning cultural pursuit. And Michael, tell us a bit more about this FA event then, that you were quite involved, I think, behind the scenes in putting that together. Where did that come from? Yeah. It kind of astonishes me that such a thoroughly secular organisation like the FA is putting so much time and effort into celebrating Christianity and football.
Yeah. What happened was, during lockdown, I remember, the Religion Media Centre were holding various press briefings every week to keep people entertained. And the FA wanted to do one with us about sport, about football and religion generally. And we hosted it. And I think we brought in a couple of people from the world of faith who are also connected with football, like Linvoy Primus, for example. And we put on a discussion around that. And then I think 2 years later, out of lockdown, an email arrived from the diversity and inclusion lead at the FA, Dal Darrick, who's a Sikh and supports Wolves. He asked, can the Religion Media Centre help again to put on an event at Wembley? At this point, I kind of, because I'm the executive chair of the Religion Media Centre, and so I have the right to do this. I sort of said, look, you know, I told my colleagues, look, leave this to me. This isn't a Religion Media Centre business. This is a Christian business for a start. You know, Religion Media Centre is non-religious, actually. We don't support any religion. This struck me as a Christian gig. And I thought, well, you know, Dal, you've actually come to the right man here. I have put on the biggest, well, with the producer, the biggest kind of football Christian event ever at Old Trafford. And then we did another one at Everton. And then we did another one at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff. So I was very used to bringing together Christianity and football, plus my own passion for football. And, you know, desire to produce things. That's what I did when I was at the BBC. So I then took it on, and I, you know, I got the parameters. He said up to 800 people, the Bobby Moore suite. You know, I was salivating at this. I'm thinking, I'm going to get in sport. I'm going to get Sports Champions UK. I'm going to get the Anglicans, the Methodists, the Roman Catholics, Cardinal Vint Nichols. You know, I knew he was a Liverpool fan. I'm going to fill it with all the sort of top people who are going to be really enthusiastic about it. And frankly, it was just pushing an open door. Everyone wanted to be involved. It really wasn't hard. And Dal had already put one on for the Hindus and the Sikhs and the Muslims at Wembley. But none of them were as big as ours. And it was, you know, quite hard to get people out, I think, for the other ones. But the Christian one was just a, you know, it was a walk in the park. And I think, given a different time of year, and had we got a Premier League player, I think we could have doubled the crowd for that, actually. I think on the day, there were about 700, but it was also a day when there was terrible snow, which stopped a lot of people from coming, including a coach from Derby, because the Bishop of Derby, Libby, was going to lead the service by the pitch, but she got snowed in. So that was a bit dramatic. And there were other, it was a train strike as well. I mean, the forces of darkness were leveled against us to stop it from happening. But, you know, we won through, as good always will. And we had a fabulous... Adrian Childs was magnificent. What a lovely man he was, with his own profound faith, his own brilliance at, you know, holding an audience and chairing the event. Simon Thomas was an angel and told his story. You know, Simon from Sky Sports. But his own faith journey, his own journey with football. It was a really wonderful day. And we did have some professional footballers there. They just weren't from the Premier League.
Yeah. And Graham, you were there as well. What were the kind of big themes that came out of the conversations you were having or the talks you were hearing? Were there kind of common threads about how Christianity and faith and football can kind of intertwine?
I think, yes, there were, and I think it's worth saying, while we're in this conversation, I haven't seen Michael since, and it was a magnificent venture. I think in probably 30 or 40 years for me now, I've been involved as a Christian in the public world of football, and it was easily the most inspiring thing I've been to. And I think that was to do with the substance of it. The big conversations were, we live in an era where there's great anxiety about mental health, well-being, purpose, meaningful lives. The residue, one might say, the residue of historical Christianity has probably gone. The cynicism about faith seems to have disappeared. There's a generation of young women and young men growing up who don't have that hangover of cynicism from Christianity in the first half of the 20th century that others of us imbibed. So there was an excitement. That's what it felt like to me, Michael. I don't know how you feel, but looking at younger men and women, there's an excitement that the Christian message is highly relevant in a world which feels it lacks meaning and purpose and hope. I found it thrilling on that level. Did you think that, Michael?
Yeah, it was really exciting. I wish in a way we'd got more young people there. In fact, I think we could have done again a different push. But the thing I can, well, it's not revealing it, but Dal, who loved the day, he was very moved by the whole thing. Couldn't believe the turnout. He said, we'll do it again in 2025 at Easter. I said, I will do it for you, Dal, if you get me a Premier League player. And I think we were that close to getting a Premier League player. We aimed at Saka particularly, and he was invited on three different levels, but Arsenal said he couldn't do it. So I was a bit shocked by that and disappointed. But I think had the chair of the FA done the inviting rather than Dal, I think we could have got him through Arsenal. And I think next time we'll try that. Maybe Saka or maybe one of the other Christian players at the top of their game, because he would have made a huge difference, obviously. People would have been queuing up.
Absolutely. I was going to mention him. He's one of a lot of others, and Marcus Rashford and others who are kind of surprisingly open about their faith, about the fact that they pray, they read the Bible. This is not just a kind of inherited thing, but this is a living part of their lives. It feels like it's almost a growing number. Is that fair, particularly with some foreign players in the Premier League as well, that there's actually a growing number of footballers who are now probably today some of the most kind of high profile public Christians we have in this country?
Yeah, well, let me cue Graham to tell his story. When you started, Graham, there were like four open Christians in the entire of football.
Well, thanks for the, you're a good producer, Mike. You just set me up. Well, it's true. I came to my own faith in 83, 84, so about 40 years ago. And I was looking for anyone who was a Christian. I was playing in the Championship. I was looking for anybody. I thought I was the only Christian, really, because I didn't know anything about churches and I didn't know anything about Christianity. So the founder of Christians in Sport, which had been going about 4 years, showed up in my football club. He was a cricketer, not a football man. And he insisted there were lots of people. He said there are lots of others playing football like Christians. So I said, well, I really haven't found anyone. I've been looking for quite a while now, 6 months, whenever I played anywhere. And he said, no, there are. I said, well, how many? And he said, well, four. I said, who are they? And he names three. And of course, and I said, well, who's the fourth? He says, you. I remember thinking, God, who pays your wages 4 years in? As we would have discussed in the event that you're talking about that Michael produced at Wembley, you really couldn't go into any changing room now in professional football in the 90 clubs. Pretty much any club you'd walk into, there are men in the men's game. I know the men's game best. There are men of Christian faith, three, four, five, pretty much every club. It's entirely changed in 40 years. It's not abnormal. And just briefly, there are obviously social factors, cultural factors to that. The wider acceptance of other faiths within our culture means that you couldn't be aggressive about people of faith at all now. Number two, I think there's a sensitivity amongst the leaders in the game now. More modern people think more eclectically. And finally, I think there were brilliant role models who are now managers. Darren Moore, for example, Nathan Jones. There are a number of people. Gavin Peacock was a good player. A number of people of faith from that era. Pardon? Klopp. Exactly. Mm-hmm. People who had... I was thinking partly there, though, Michael, just... Klopp definitely in the contemporary era, but people who came to their own faith as players in the 90s influenced people who are in management today or they're in management themselves. And people have said effectively, without knowing it, gosh, you can be a Christian and a highly competitive coach or manager. They're not incongruous. That was previously a presupposition that you couldn't do both.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's some of the factors behind the modern shift. God's kindness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know there's a couple of Norwich players who are very open about their faith on their who we follow on Twitter. There's a new young man called Ken Abo, who's very open about his. And of course, Johnny Rowe, who's being noticed by all the Premier League clubs. Unfortunately, they're going to nick him, but you know he's very, very clear about his faith.
Yeah, I think. And there's something I wonder as well about growing diversity in the game. And that as football has opened up to people from all parts of Britain and overseas, I think, you know, often, if we're honest, it's kind of the white British community which has turned its back on faith the most. And actually, when you see players like Saka and Rashford coming through, actually in black British communities, it's very normalised still to go to church and to be open and proud about your faith. There isn't that same kind of awkwardness that maybe some of us white British people feel. Do you think that's fair, Graham?
Yes, of course it's fair. Culturally, in terms of diversity, it's very fair. And yet, simultaneous with that, I do think that certainly young men that I know in football, people under 30, 35, they've had a combination of meeting people who are Christians from overseas in professional football. They've had coaches or no coaches who are Christians, and they don't know Christianity. They literally don't know. I mean, I sat in a little room not very long ago at all with four or five young players, and we were working through a version of Christianity Explored or Alpha, you know, that, a version of that. And we got to the week before the cross, and we finished, and we were doing the cross next week. And one of the boys on the way out said, called me Dano. He said, Dano, seriously now, I know we're doing this next week, but tell me what happened to him. Tell me what happened to the bloke. I said, which bloke, mate? He said, Jesus. I said, what do you mean, what happened to him? He said, well, what happened? Did they kill him? A 22-year-old man, not thick, bright, had no clue. White British guy, had no clue.
Good gracious.
Remarkable. But equally thrilling, because when I told him what happened, he went, whoa! Can you believe it? Did that really happen? How do we know? And off you go. You're doing apologetics as if in the other side of the world. So that may be an exception, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So I think the world's different. Mm. I'm excited about it. I have to say, I really am.
Yeah.
I heard an organisation yesterday that's called KICK. Have you come across this?
Yes, KICK.
Yeah. I mean that's working with it's not just football but you know other round ball games. I believe it may even have oval ball games, but it's working with kids and bringing them to faith through football again. So that's a very successful new movement, I gather.
Yes, and I think Michael that represents away from the pros side of things now, the elite end. I think the cultural shift we're talking about, much more inclusive, more eclectic. I think schools, you know, this KICK is a trailblazer, but there are a number of organizations, Christian organizations, who provide sport in schools. They're known to be Christians. They'll do assemblies, but there's not you can't come in here, you're religious. That's not happening so much. It's just so healthy. Good for democracy as well, by the way. You know, we live in a liberal democracy and it's actually proving quite a healthy state at the moment.
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
What was it like for you, Graham, then in the 80s, then before this shift happened, when you were, were you able to tell your teammates, your managers about your faith? Did you get a lot of stick in the dressing room? Did you have to keep it quiet? What was your experience like?
Hammered. Absolutely hammered. When Billy Graham was at, I mean, for young people, this is like a million years ago. But when Billy Graham was speaking in East Anglia in 1984, the great American evangelist, I had just come to faith. So I invited my teammates to come. It was pre-season training. And it was Carrow Road, I think we were. I won't say the other place, Michael. I'm pretty sure it was Carrow Road. And yeah. So I invited my teammates because there weren't games. It was a Friday night. There was a Saturday pre-season, no match. I took the boys. And, you know, for those who won't know, Billy Graham used to preach and then he'd ask people to come onto the pitch. I mean, the ground would be rammed. He'd ask people to come onto the pitch to profess their faith. Of course, I didn't know he was going to do this. I just took the boys to hear Billy Graham because somebody told me he was very good. So I'm looking along the row with the boys at the back of the stand at Norwich City, and I'm looking at them, and they're looking at me, and they're going, are we supposed to go to the front? Are we supposed to go on the pitch? I said, I don't know. Yes. Uh-huh. And they said, and then you can imagine the expletives. Well, I'm effing not. So, well, yeah, I think the thing back, you know, it's a different era. And that was an era really until post 2000, I would say, where if you were different in a soccer dressing room, anything different, your clothes, your accent, the color of your skin, anything, you were up to be knocked down. And of course, that was a pretty toxic culture. And happily, Christianity fell into that bracket. If you're a Christian, you had just got boshed for it. And they're gone. Those days are gone. It's great. They're gone in culture. They're not completely gone. They'll never be completely gone.
No.
But there's a cultural shift.
But they're gone. But incredible ignorance around it, though, as your previous story demonstrated.
Yeah. Oh.
Desperate religious illiteracy, which is one of the things I try to address in lots of different ways. Yeah.
Oh, say more about that. That's interesting, because I've never heard anyone talk about religious illiteracy. I see that all the time in dressing rooms now. Yeah. All the time.
What the religious illiteracy?
Certainly, I can talk about Christianity. That story is not a one-off. People not knowing the Christian story, the basic Christian story, is not a one-off in professional football.
Yeah, well, there's a report we can get that was published by the government last year, the Bloom Report, which says there should be religious literacy training throughout the civil service. And we're responding to that at the moment, just to make sure that people kind of, you know, they know, at least know the basics. But also, more importantly than that, I think, is this disposition towards religion, which we've been addressing a bit now. That's got to change too, because too many people think religious people are mad, don't go out very often, and have no friends. You know, that's not healthy, because religious people is sort of normal.
I was going to say that's probably me, but it's not because I'm religious.
And what about the other idea I want to talk about is I've come across a few football clubs have chaplains who kind of are attached to them, often local pastors. How commonplace is that? And could you guys be able to say how are they kind of received inside a football club? If there's a, you know, we're used to having chaplains in a hospital context maybe, or a school, but seems interesting to have the idea of chaplaincy in a football club. How does that work?
Well, Michael could speak into the Old Trafford event that long time ago, because John Boyers was behind that, wasn't he? And I'll comment then on current chaplaincy.
Well, I know John Boyers was an important figure at Manchester United. And when we did our Songs of Praise from there, he was crucial to us. But I know of other chaplains at other clubs. I know Norwich City have got an evangelical chaplain, I believe, who I presume Johnny Rowe goes to his church. I'm not sure. And I know when we were trying to get chaplains to come to the event at Wembley, I tried to get hold of the chaplain at Liverpool, who's a Roman Catholic priest, but I couldn't get near him. I mean, I think the ones that are actually on the inside are very hard to get hold of because they have such access to the players. So you have to be very careful, you know, talking to them. Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I know Macclesfield Town, because I live near there. They had the Methodist minister who was at my church. He was their chaplain for a while. But when he left, appointed another one. There isn't one there now, I gather.
Ah, okay. Well, I do know, Michael, Matt Baker was with us at Wembley, and he heads up chaplaincy for Sports Chaplaincy UK. And he's actually salaried by the Premier League, the EFL, and the Players Union. There are around of the 92 clubs, professional clubs, around 78 to 80 have got a chaplain. Wow. Nearly every club has. In fact, Arsenal haven't. They're one of the few clubs actually that haven't got one. So I would say chaplaincy, since John Boyer has started his work in the 90s and Sports Chaplaincy UK took it on later on around the noughties, it's deeply embedded in professional football and indeed rugby now. So it's a big shift that's happened there. Very normal.
And would they have real meaningful access to the players? Would the players kind of like be able to say, you know, I want to have a chat with the chaplain, or do they just kind of swan in a few times a season? How does it work?
Well, I think everyone will be different, of course. And the weakness with professional sport compared to, I guess, pretty much any profession is that head coaches change so quickly.
Yeah.
But when managers and head coaches change so quickly, you could have a brilliant relationship with one manager and then the next guy doesn't want anybody who's not, forget they're a Christian, anybody who's not an insider at the training ground, and your continuity's gone. So they're the worst challenges. But I know some many fantastic chaplains, really fantastic. The players are cared for by them, looked after by them, mentored by them. Christian or not, I mean. I know some fantastic chaplains. It's a great work.
So, Tim, you must know that if Arsenal doesn't have a chaplain, they're never going to win the Premiership. That's what's been holding them up.
I thought they were God's own team, Michael. I was convinced of that. Something's gone wrong there.
But look at Liverpool with their amount of contact with God throughout the team, including the manager, is so strong that it's no wonder they're doing so well. I mean, look at their goalkeeper baptizes people in his swimming pool. Their manager's very open about his faith. They got Mo Salah, you know, just covering all bases.
Yeah. I mean, you know. It's quite a story, isn't it? It's quite a story. And just lastly, running out of time, but just lastly then, we talked at the beginning about how a lot of football clubs began because churches saw football as a brilliant way of kind of working with young people. Do you think that still stands the test of time today? We talked a lot about the kind of professional level, but do you think running a football club would be a really worthwhile endeavour for a church, a local church today? Is it still a brilliant way to kind of get young people thinking about faith and talking about these things?
Well, tragically, I don't think there's enough young people to make up a football team in most churches. Yeah. Certainly wouldn't be in mine.
Yeah. Mike, there is a place, Michael, which isn't miles from you, well, your home team, rather, in Bury St. Edmunds. So rather than going broad on this, the best model I've ever seen is in Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk. There's a team called Sporting 87, hence started in 87. So they're 40 years in now. They've got probably a couple of thousand boys and girls, women and men, in their teams right from childhood right through. So they simply play in the local leagues, in the Suffolk, sort of East Anglian leagues. They're run by Christians. But of course, it's such a range of coaching staff and players that it's a small number of people who would be regular churchgoers. And they walk an incredible, they're almost like a 19th century, you know, a version of the 19th century initiative in 2024. So there are really good models of this around the country, and they're a very good standard model of it. So as Michael says, it may not be many young children, people or young children in churches, but the ability of the church to reach out and include people in community, often in lonely worlds, is as strong as ever. It's as powerful as ever, important as ever, and worth a look at.
Yeah, because it's just, as you say, Michael, you know, it's notoriously challenging for churches in kind of a secular 21st century Britain to gather large groups of young people together. But, you know, wherever you go, you see people doing a kickabout in the park, and it'd be just really interesting to see if Christians, if churches could find a way of connecting up with those people who aren't coming on Sundays, aren't part of their regular kind of youth group or Sunday school. But, you know, clearly we did it once. We found a way of speaking the same language of faith and football. And and that good. Something's quite spectacular. So yeah, love to see it happen again. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I could love talking about this all day. It's really been fun. But thank you, Graham. Thank you, Michael. Good luck to Norwich and Cambridge, as always, as long as you don't play Arsenal, which we're not going to have anytime
we're
soon.
We're not playing you. We're not playing you. Soon.
Been really fun talking about this, guys, and really grateful for your time. Thank you, everyone else, for listening. We'll be back with another episode next week. But until then, bye-bye.
That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But before you go, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. And why not tell a friend about the show too? And if you'd like even more church news analysis, you can also subscribe to my new free email newsletter, The Critical Friend. Each week, I send an email packed with links to interesting things happening in the church world and my commentary on them. Just visit tswyatt.substack.com to find out more and subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.